This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
It's known as the Gurdon Light. For more than 60 years, the same eerie, luminous apparition has been described by hundreds of eyewitnesses. Is it some as yet unexplained natural phenomenon? Or is it, as many say, the restless ghost of a long-dead railroad man doomed to wander the tracks for eternity? This man, Stuart Heaton, was convicted of murdering a 16-year-old girl, largely on the strength of DNA test results. But all along, Heaton has claimed that he is innocent, that the DNA tests were flawed, and some prominent scientific experts agree with him. Call them the real-life Thelma and Louise, on the road and on the run. A middle-class wife and mother and her best friend who allegedly thrilled in seducing, terrorizing, and then robbing men they met through the personals. Also tonight, a heartwarming reunion brought about by your calls. Join me for another edition of Unsolved Mysteries. Welcome to Gurdon, Arkansas, population 2,700, a typical small town, apparently no different from hundreds of other communities that dot the railroad between St. Louis and Dallas. But as darkness descends, an air of expectancy settles over Gurdon. Most nights, the locals anticipate the arrival of their very own unsolved mystery. For decades, on the tracks just outside of town, an eerie, unexplained light of unknown origin has been magically appearing. This time-lapse photograph was taken in November by an Unsolved Mysteries photographer. It is apparently the first time that the strange phenomenon known locally as the Gurdon Light has been captured on film. A few days later, the photographer returned to the railroad tracks. He waited until nightfall and recorded this mysterious light on videotape. This is an enlargement of the image, the same image seen by hundreds of eyewitnesses over the years.
I'd say that I've seen it where I couldn't write it off as being anything else, probably 20, 25 times at least. And I'm a very skeptical person.
Over the years, I have personally seen it hundreds of times with my father and my family.
I've seen the light at least 60 or 70 times. And of course, usually when you see it one time in that evening, you can see it several times in succession.
What is the Gurdon Light? A natural phenomenon? A long-running prank? Or perhaps something that cannot be explained. Not surprisingly, that possibility inevitably prompts a retelling of the legend that goes along with the Gurdon Light. It all began on a chilly December evening in 1931. Around midnight, Will McLean, a section foreman for the railroad, confronted one of his workers, Lewis McBride.
I've got something I need to tell you, and I want you.
It doesn't concern any of you boys, now go on, clock out.
The day before, a freight train had derailed just outside Gurdon. McLean suspected that McBride had sabotaged a section of the track.
This is your last night, McBride. Get your pay, get on out of here.
Why? I think you know why. I need this job.
Well, you should have thought about that before you pulled that crazy little stunt.
But I have a family.
I don't want to hear any more about it. Just pick up your pay and get off the yard.
I need this job.
When McLean failed to return home, a search party was hastily assembled. They came upon a trail of blood and followed it along the tracks to the edge of town.
What is that? It's McLean's. Just look off down yonder.
At the end of the blood trail lay the body of Will McLean. By dawn, Lewis McBride had confessed to the murder. In February of 1932, he was executed at the state penitentiary. It wasn't long before people began seeing the Girden light on a regular basis. Local lore said it was the ghost of Will McLean, doomed to spend eternity walking the tracks with his lantern. One of the earliest sightings is one of the most memorable. As a train approached town, an elderly conductor named John stepped onto the back of the caboose and was startled by what he saw.
They say that John went out on the back platform to investigate, and the light was real far off and kind of faint, but it seemed to be traveling the same speed they were. And then all of a sudden it just shot up, and he was just like paralyzed and just hanging on to the grab iron and just transfixed, staring right into the light.
According to John, the light followed the train for more than a mile. Finally, it veered off in the direction of the cemetery. Ever since, looking for the Girden light has become something of a local pastime.
If you go down there with some regularity, you're definitely going to see it. After a while, you may go a few days, you know, where you get frustrated and you don't see it, but with a little time and a little concentration, you most definitely will see the light. My friends and I always went down there with the hopes of seeing the light. And walking down the tracks, just in the total darkness, always left you with a little eerie feeling. I've seen it come on in a quick flash and seen it fade in and then fade back out. Sometimes we've gotten pretty scared down there, seeing the light together with maybe some noises in the woods have sent us running out of there quite often.
The descriptions of the light are for the most part consistent. It seems to float 1 to 3 feet above the tracks and often changes colors. The light is rarely visible for more than 10 seconds at a time.
There are many times when I walk down the tracks by myself and spent several hours out there, and during the course of that time, you can be observing the light and move toward it and it'll disappear, and you'll turn around and it'll be behind you. Almost everybody has had that kind of experience from time to time with it. Local legend is, if it gets behind you, you can't get back to your car.
The whole town has seen it at some point in time, and it's not a figment of anybody's imagination. It does exist. It is there. What is it? That's the question.
That is indeed the question. Is the Girden light, as some believe, the ghost of Will McLean? Or is there a rational, scientific explanation?
Across Highway 53,
For years, Dr. Charles Lemming, a physics professor at Henderson State University, took his classes to Gurdon in search of an answer.
When I first went out to see the Gurdon light and studied the area maps, I was pretty confident that the light always originated from car headlights on an interstate bridge a few miles away.
The light is usually seen in this area, just outside Gurdon. The highway lies to the southwest, 4 miles away.
The problem with the headlight theory is that we're sure people were going out before the interstate opened in 1970. We could find reliable accounts of people that went out to see the Gurdon light and reported the Gurdon light well before the interstate bridge that we thought was the origin of the headlights was opened.
A second theory is that the light is in fact swamp gas, a spontaneous combustion of the gases produced when dense vegetation decomposes.
A good distance down that way too.
The theory of it being swamp gas doesn't hold up to me just because I've seen it on a windy night. So that would eliminate any sort of swamp gas out there.
The closest theory that I've come to for explaining the Gurdon light is the piezoelectric effect. And piezoelectricity is a simple phenomenon where if you squeeze crystals such as quartz or Rochelle salt, you get an electric current out of them.
Gurdon sits atop an abundant deposit of quartz crystals and an active fault line known as the New Madrid Fault. Michael Klingen believes that when the plates shift, an electric charge is released from the crystals and seen above ground as the Gurdon light.
People tend to say that the light appeared after the murder of Will McLean. And looking back, that also coincides with a major earthquake on the New Madrid fault line. So that tends to support my piezoelectric theory.
Klingen acknowledges that there is one large hole in his theory. He cannot explain how the charge migrates to the surface or why it is concentrated in a ball-like shape.
I don't think if they came forth with a logical explanation, I would truly believe it. It is too mysterious, and I don't think it can be explained.
Do we really want to know that it what it is? Because that would take all the mystery out of it and all the fun. And I would like to see my children's children take their children down there, just like our parents took us down there. It's a perfect setting for a ghost story.
What is the secret of the Gurdon light? If there is a scientific explanation, it has certainly eluded everyone for the past 60 years. Until something better comes along, we're left with the legend of poor old Will McLean's ghost wandering the railroad tracks forevermore, perhaps in search of the man who killed him. When we return, the controversial case of Stuart Heaton. Did faulty DNA evidence put the wrong man in prison for murder? In recent months, most of us have at least heard of the legal debate over the use of DNA evidence in criminal cases. Many experts believe DNA can identify a suspect as reliably as a fingerprint. Others strongly disagree. Tonight, that debate has a special resonance for a young man named Stuart Heaton. He is serving a life sentence for murder, even though many believe there is compelling evidence that another man committed the crime. Stuart insists that he is innocent, and that crucial DNA evidence, which some say is deeply flawed, helped put him behind bars. Ramsey, Illinois, in the south central part of the state, is a peaceful rural community. But on July 23rd, 1991, a brutal murder shocked its citizens. 16-year-old Crystal Knabb, a high school sophomore, had been stabbed 81 times in the living room of her family's trailer.
Hey, Brian, what do you got there?
Well, I think I have your murder weapon. Looks like a pair of sewing scissors. And I'll tell you, the person who did this, you can't stab somebody that many times without getting cuts on your hands. Look for somebody with cuts either on the outside of their fingers or on their palm.
I wonder if you happen to see anything suspicious.
Several neighbors told police they had noticed a white pickup truck, most probably a Dodge, parked outside the Knabb's trailer earlier that day from around 10 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Say like a Dodge pickup truck. Do you know anybody that has a truck like that?
Next, the police talked with Crystal's brother, Curtis Knapp.
A friend of mine. I haven't seen him for like 2 or 3 years, though. Stuart Heaton.
Stuart Heaton. Do you happen to know where this Stuart Heaton lives?
He used to live about 3 miles up the road.
Uh-huh. Is he married?
I don't know.
Okay, you haven't seen him in that long, though, two
yeah,
or 3 years?
It's been at least 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
Good evening.
Police located Stuart Heaton in nearby Bluff City, Illinois, where he worked as a carpenter and roofer. He did, in fact, own a white Dodge pickup and had married 2 years earlier, several months after he lost touch with Curtis Knapp.
Mr. Heaton, if you'd step out on the porch just for a second.
What do you want to ask me?
Mr. Heaton, would you put your hands behind your back?
What for?
What are you doing?
I just want to ask you a couple of questions.
What is
what about?
Going on here?
I haven't done anything wrong.
We're just
going
to take you down to the station
and
ask
here,
you a few questions, that's all.
Stuart! Right.
Yeah, Karen, call my mom.
Where are they taking you?
The police station.
Watch for your head.
Where'd you get these cuts on your hands, Stuart?
Yeah, I'm flashing.
I'm laying a roof. You sometimes bang your hands when you're working construction.
Hold nice. Real still for me, okay, Steve?
Both on the outer and on the palms, too. What about this one on your forehead? Did you,
It's not
careless?
A cut, it's a pimple.
Yeah? Take a shot of that, Tom.
Can I put my hands down now?
Just
you
a
can
second.
Put them down now, Stu. Just hold real still.
We got to know a little bit about what you did today. What was your day like? When'd you wake up? Where'd you go?
I left my house at 9. I gave an estimate for a roofing job.
Where'd you give the estimate, Stuart?
Stu?
Look, why am I answering these questions?
Stu.
I haven't done anything wrong.
I need you to
what
hold
you?
Real
he doesn't
still.
Know why he's, hey. He's done anything wrong.
The two crime scene technicians came back and told me this guy has the cuts. This is our man. From the beginning. And for a while, though, that was all we had connecting him to the crime scene were the cuts. There was just too big of a coincidence for them to say that the guy we're looking for is going to have this, and the suspect they picked up immediately had exactly what they said we'd find.
I know for a fact that I'm innocent. Nobody else may know for a fact, but I know for a fact. If they were half the investigator that he would lead the public to believe, then he would have checked and found out that I'll always have cuts on my hand. You know, there wasn't nothing abnormal. A carpenter without cuts on his hands is not a carpenter. He's an observer, and I'm a carpenter.
We were told that he had been picked up, Stuart Heaton had been picked up for her murder. And afterwards, we learned that there was a possibility because he had cuts on his hands, his forehead, he had a mark on his leg, and they started doing some investigation and people had seen his truck.
Step inside.
Stuart Heaton was indicted on September 11th, 1991. He voluntarily waived his right to a speedy trial. After a search warrant was obtained, police took a blood sample from Stuart for DNA testing. An autopsy had been performed on Crystal Knapp. She was 3 months pregnant, and a trace of dried yellow material, which contained semen, was found on her pubic hair. Crystal's boyfriend had been eliminated as a suspect. The authorities wanted to find out if the semen matched Stuart Heaton's DNA. For more than 4 months, Stuart languished in jail, awaiting the DNA test results, which he felt would exonerate him once and for all.
Heaton?
Yes, sir.
You got a delivery.
Thank you.
However, when his lawyer forwarded the test results, they were not what Stuart Heaton had hoped for. There was a chance the Stuart's DNA did match the semen sample found on Crystal's body. In spite of this, Stuart remained optimistic.
I didn't know as much about DNA and genetic testing then as I do now. But when I read that, I looked at that and I hung on to that. And I said, there's only a chance. You know, this test isn't exact. They can't say, oh, it matches. I mean, they said there was a chance. In my mind, reasonable doubt.
I had read all that. I knew there was no way. And when I looked at it, I thought, it's not him. Besides all the other forensic evidence, they had 25 pages of hair, skin, tissue, blood, fingerprints, and not a one was Stuart's. You couldn't be. It's an impossibility to be in a place from 10 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon and not leave something. And there's nobody smart enough to clean up theirs, just theirs, and leave everybody else's. It's impossible. It can't be done.
The Dodge pickup and the cuts on Stewart's hands notwithstanding, he and his family were confident going into the trial, but they would be sorely disappointed. Curtis Knapp, Crystal's brother, gave damaging testimony. He claimed that one night between 2 and 3 years earlier, he had found Stewart in the Knapp's trailer with his older sister, Melody.
Now, when you say he was talking to your sister, where was he located in the trailer at that time?
In the bedroom.
And where was your sister?
In the bedroom.
Of course, his testimony was completely different from his mom's on that. He said he answered the door, and that I came in. He asked me to leave, and all this and that. I think even at one point he said that he woke up and I was there. But that night when I stopped by, his mom answered the door. I asked for Curtis. She went and got Curtis, and we sat down at the kitchen table, and I drank a couple of beers and talked.
They asked me 3 times.
Stewart's wife was called by the prosecution as a hostile witness, as was his mother. Their testimony indicated that Stewart might have changed clothes on the day of the murder.
I can tell you that in the morning he had a t-shirt on, but as far as, you know, pants and stuff, I'd have to say sweatpants because he couldn't fit in his jeans.
Why all of a sudden now do you just say sweatpants?
Because I...
The prosecution theorized that Stewart had hidden a pair of blue jeans bloodied during the murder of Crystal Knapp.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Two witnesses, one woman and one man, took the stand to establish an alibi for Stewart between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. on the day of the murder. But the prosecutor shot holes in their testimony. Against his family's advice, Stewart decided not to testify on his own behalf. He says his court-appointed lawyer had not prepared him to take the stand. Stewart also says his religion teaches that faith must be put in God rather than in any individual, including oneself.
With regard to the semen samples...
As the capstone of the prosecution's case, an expert witness testified that there was a probability that Stewart Heaton's DNA matched the semen sample.
The DNA profile found in this case that matches the DNA profile of Mr. Heaton would be expected to be found once out of every 52,600 non-related Caucasians tested.
Those odds, relative to other cases where DNA has been used as evidence, are not in fact very impressive. The odds needed before many experts feel comfortable are more in the neighborhood of 1,000,000 to 1. Nevertheless, the jury found the prosecution's expert convincing.
The jury has returned 2 signed verdicts. First signed verdict, we, the jury, find the defendant, Stewart Heaton, guilty of first-degree murder, count 1.
I was expecting a not guilty verdict. And after I left the courtroom, I got across to the county jail, in there with family and friends. And at that point, I cried. Held on to my wife and I cried. And we decided we'd go on and keep fighting it. I don't quit.
I feel for the family that lost their child. I am not that kind of person. I know what it is to lose a child, and they had to hurt bad. But the worst thing that could happen was put the wrong man in prison for it.
Stewart Heaton was sentenced to life in prison at the Menard Correctional Center in Chester, Illinois. The judge ruled that Stewart would never be eligible for parole.
I am convinced that the DNA evidence in this case was the linchpin of the prosecution's case, that without it, the prosecution had a weak circumstantial case. Jurors were wowed by the scientific evidence of 52,000 to 1 odds against Stewart Heaton, and that did it. In the end of the day, a weak case was made a strong one based on this evidence that I believe is phony evidence.
David Protes is an investigative journalist and professor at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. His research has led him to conclude that the real criminal is still at large and that Stewart Heaton was railroaded.
If he hadn't owned a white truck, he wouldn't have even been a suspect in this case. I did a search through Department of Motor Vehicle records for the state of Illinois that found that in Fayette County alone, there were more than 100 white trucks that were similar to the kind that Stewart Heaton drove. And in fact, in narrowing that search down, I identified 12 white Dodge Dakotas, including Stuart Heaton's. One of those Dodge Dakotas belonged to a man with a lengthy criminal history who knew the murder victim, Crystal Knapp.
Could the DNA sample found on Crystal Knapp's body belong to someone other than Stuart Heaton? According to the statistical method used in Stuart's trial, there are more than 4,800 people in the United States whose DNA would have matched the sample. And when a new statistical method widely used today is applied, that number rises from 4,800 to around 48,000.
There's no dispute that DNA evidence to exclude somebody is generally accepted. If we look just at one place on a gene and they don't match, then we know that those people don't match. The problem is when you try to include people. We can prove, for example, that somebody isn't the father of a child by DNA tests, and we can prove that to 100% scientific acceptability. But when we try to prove who is the father, who is the murderer, that's where we run into difficulties.
Bob Byman and his associate Shelley Malinowski have taken on the Stuart Heaton case pro bono for no fee. They believe not only the Stewart is innocent, but that Dr. Robert Allen, the DNA expert for the prosecution, used a controversial method of calculating the odds against Stewart.
2 years after he testified in the Stewart Heaton case, Robert Allen published an article with several other renowned scientists that rejected the statistical assumptions that he himself had used in the Stuart Heaton evidence.
And I think that the main reason that he was convicted was that the jurors were completely overwhelmed by the complexity of the DNA evidence, and they saw it as infallible, when in fact it's not.
To across the board deny the use of DNA evidence because it's low, I believe it is not fair. I think that it should in fact be admissible, and here that's what a jury is for. As a trier of the fact, let them determine whether the odds are low in relation to everything else and all the other evidence in the case, or whether they're significant.
This probe here represents the...
The single most important issue in the DNA testimony of Stuart Heaton's trial was interpretation of the evidence. This is an autoradiogram, or autorad, of DNA taken from the murder victim, Crystal Knapp. The two distinct bands represent DNA from a region in which individuals are very likely to be different genetically. Juxtapose another DNA sample taken from a different area on Crystal Knapp's body, and the two bands also show up clearly. A perfect match, because both samples come from the same person. The trial boiled down to a debate between two expert witnesses over whether bands were present in the semen sample found on Crystal Knapp's body. And if they were, did they match the bands in Stuart Heaton's DNA profile? This autorad compares Stuart Heaton's DNA with DNA from the semen sample. The small pinpoint dots on the left borders mark the places where Dr. Allen said he saw bands which link Stuart Heaton to the semen.
Based upon your examination of the autoradiographs,
the defense expert, Dr. Gary Littman, said he was unable to detect those critical bands.
As I said, there's no band. There simply is no band there.
The sample itself was old, crusty material that was minute in quantity. It probably did not provide an adequate basis for even conducting a DNA test, and certainly not the type of DNA test that was done here. We unearthed a letter in which, prior to his reaching conclusions, Dr. Robert Allen said that he hoped that the DNA test would end up implicating Stuart Heaton. Now, that is scientific subjectivity that should disqualify him as an expert in this case.
I'm certain that Dr. Allen did the best that he could with what was available to him, but that material simply wasn't in the best condition, and it didn't lead then to very clear-cut results. There was a lot of smudges. It's difficult to say unambiguously that a band is present and a band is not present.
Dr. Dan Crane has co-authored articles on DNA testing with Dr. Robert Allen. Yet in the case of Stuart Heaton, Dr. Crane disputes the conclusions of his colleague.
based on the DNA evidence alone, I would feel very uncomfortable sending a man to prison on that evidence alone. Now, there may well have been other compelling evidence of which I'm not aware, but the DNA evidence by itself certainly would leave a large area of doubt in my mind as to whether or not that he was in fact the person who was at that crime scene.
I mean, it wasn't just DNA that convicted him. It was people that saw him, saw the truck, and people that testified to, you know, where they saw him at, the times. And, I mean, people that saw the truck at the home. That's what I think helped convict him, that plus the DNA.
There's no doubt in my mind, no doubt whatsoever, that he killed her. He killed her in an extremely vicious, sick manner. He's extremely dangerous. He has to be locked up. If he is released, I do believe that he will kill again. He has to be locked up, and the court system worked, and it worked right.
I did not kill Crystal Knapp. I don't know the girl. I don't have any reason to have any grudge against her or her family or anything. I didn't know her.
When we return, two sisters are joyfully reunited after more than 20 years apart. In June of 1994, we brought you the poignant story of Diane Handline of La Crescenta, California. Since 1986, Diane has battled a rare and often fatal blood disease.
Diane has a relatively unusual blood disorder, normally considered to be an incurable illness, now potentially could be cured by the utilization of a bone marrow transplantation, fraught with a lot of dangers, though, and a lot of potential complications, so not something to be taken lightly.
Only one person, Diane's younger sister Marilyn, was a potential bone marrow donor. But Diane had no idea where to find Marilyn.
Bye.
Bye.
The sisters had been split up in 1954 when their parents separated. Marilyn went to live with her father. Diane stayed with her mother. Over the next few years, contact was sporadic. And for reasons long since forgotten, the sisters became estranged.
I feel I'm asking a lot of my sister to do this bone marrow for me. But even if she doesn't agree to a transplant, if she doesn't say, I don't want to do this, I would still like to make peace with her. She's my sister.
When we broadcast Diane's story, a private investigator from Denver, Colorado, Robin Lee, was watching. She was touched by Diane's plight, but assumed we would get the clues we needed. We didn't. As luck would have it, Robin was also watching when the segment reran in June. This time, she decided to volunteer her help in tracking Marilyn down. The result was one of our most unusual solves ever.
I contacted the show, got a little more information. Started out with the sister's name. Marilyn Jones was her maiden name. Started with that and a date of birth, and went on from there. And it took me about 3 days to find her, 3 working days, if you don't count the 4th of July holiday in between. And I think it's great that they're back together.
On August 13th, 1994, Marilyn and Diane met face to face for the first time in 30 years.
It's so good to see you.
Once we hugged, it was like it hadn't been 30 years. It had been, you know, just short time. I guess maybe that's why I feel comfortable, is because I can feel the love. And when you feel that love, you feel comfortable.
Get over, you haven't changed a bit.
Oh, no, yeah. No, I get cuter with age.
Yes,
honey.
Yes, you do.
I think I'm still in shock. You know, it's still like, I'm not here yet. It's just a dream, you know. But it's a great dream, and we have a lot of catching up to do, and we'll be together forever now. We're going to have a lot of fun together. Enjoy the time we have.
Isn't that beautiful?
Coincidentally, the day of the reunion was Diane's 53rd birthday. and Marilyn had not forgotten.
Beautiful. Is my name it's spelled right?
This is the best gift I've ever had in my whole life. This is the best gift ever, is to have my sister and to have my family for my birthday. It'll be the best birthday I've ever had in my whole life.
We drive 60 miles to go to...
On the day of the reunion, Marilyn's fondest wish was to prove a compatible bone marrow donor for her sister.
And how far do you drive to go to the movies?
Oh, to the movies, we have to go all the way to Canada, and that's the closest
I want more than anything to have this work with Diane. But even if it doesn't, we're going to take full advantage of however long we do have together. We can make a week seem like an eternity.
I think they were just out for a joyride, best friends without a care in the world. But like everything else about Rose Turford and Carolyn Stevens, looks can be deceiving. To the police, these two women are nothing less than the real-life Thelma and Louise. Today, Turford and Stevens are armed, dangerous, and on the run, wanted on multiple charges of aggravated robbery.
Carolyn.
Yeah, okay.
We're running a little late.
They met in 1992. Right. Both were nurses at a psychiatric hospital in Houston, Texas. Eventually, Rose invited Carolyn to move in with her and her family. By January of 1995, the two women had embarked on a vicious game. Rose Turford was, by all accounts, a loving wife, devoted mother, and dedicated professional. But at night, she took on a whole new persona.
Here we are. Got the wine, the key.
Great.
The room's right here.
Oh, good.
Okay. Rose began soliciting men through the personals.
Thank you.
Then she would lure her dates to out-of-the-way motel rooms.
To us.
A little soft music, a good bottle of wine, and the stage was set for Carolyn's entrance.
Sit down on the bed.
The Thelma and Louise bandits move quickly and methodically.
Now take off your clothes. I'm going to the bank. Guess I'll see.
Finally, Carolyn would be left to stand guard while Rose ran out to use a victim's bank and credit cards.
Rose and Carolyn, from the onset, wanted to be the real-life Thelma and Louise. They wanted to experience that thrill and the spontaneity, and the only thing is, I don't believe they ever considered what they were going to do to their families.
Over a three-month period, Rose and Carolyn reportedly robbed at least 10 men of more than $250,000. But eventually, their luck ran out. In March of 1995, Rose and Carolyn were arrested. Bail was set at $250,000 each.
It seems as though prior to both Rose and Carolyn going to jail and being arrested, they had this pact that if one got out, they both got out, or they both stayed in. And Rose's parents were just going to get Rose out of jail.
Look, I'm sorry I have to keep calling you, but Avery is putting pressure on me.
In an attempt to cajole Rose's family into posting bail for both of them, Carolyn phoned Rose's parents repeatedly.
To hurt the kids.
She claimed that a mysterious international private investigator named Avery was threatening Rose's children.
But Rose and I know what he's capable of, and we should all take him seriously.
Probably the weirdest part of this whole scenario was the man named Avery. I never bought that he was real. It was just too far-fetched.
Rose's family, however, believed Avery was real. Even her in-laws were moved to act. They put up their house and restaurant as partial collateral.
I tried to convince that the parents don't make both bonds. And it's not often that you sit and try to speak to someone about not giving you $25,000. But I just knew it was a problem, and I knew it wasn't going to work, and it didn't.
Sure enough, on May 22nd, 1995, Rose Turford and Carolyn Stevens took flight. Left behind was a letter which alleged that they had been kidnapped by the mysterious Avery. In reality, the Thelma and Louise bandits were on the run, leaving Rose's in-laws in danger of losing their home and business.
We wanted to help in any way we could. I never once entered my mind that they would disappear. Never.
I really hope that, and Rose and Carolyn, just stop and think. They're going to basically throw really, really good, honest, hardworking people out in the streets. And if they have to go to jail, well, that's just kind of the price you pay for making a mistake. But it's a lot better to pay price once than to pay it all your life and make your kids and your family suffer for a lifetime.
Join me next time for another intriguing edition of Unsolved Mysteries. Thank you.